Over the past month, Nigerians have taken to the streets calling for an end to corruption. Nigeria is Africa's most populous nation with 160 million people. The country makes $45 billion a year in oil revenue, yet 70% of Nigerians live on less than a dollar a day, and the unemployment rate is over 70% in some areas. Labor unions in Nigeria ended a six-day national strike on January 17th after the president announced the oil subsidy would end. On today's Your Call, we're talking about what's happening on the ground in Nigeria, who is getting wealthy off of Nigeria's oil, and what will it take to change a corrupt system that benefits the Nigerian government and big oil. Join us after the news.
BBC News with Ian Purden. There's been another onslaught by the Syrian army on the city of Homs, with hundreds of shells and mortars fired into populated areas throughout the day. A BBC correspondent, Paul Wood, witnessed the bombardment in Homs and says residents are calling it the worst bombardment since the uprising began almost a year ago.
Daybreak in Homs. The artillery fire was just beginning. In this part of the city, it is the worst they have endured. Eyewitnesses say a field clinic was hit. They filmed the injured being moved. Over several days of this, most of the casualties have been civilians. The houses don't have basements. There's nowhere to hide. Even in the midst of all this, most hide their faces. They say there's no telling what the regime will do.
The United States has closed its embassy in Damascus. It says the Syrian authorities failed to respond adequately to its security concerns. In Britain, the Foreign Secretary William Hague strongly criticised Russia and China for their veto of a resolution on Syria at the UN.
We regard this veto as a grave error of judgment by the governments of China and Russia. Mr. Speaker, there is no need to mince words about this. Such vetoes are a betrayal of the Syrian people. In deploying them, they have placed themselves on the wrong side of Arab and international opinion.
Earlier, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov branded as hysterical Western and Arab anger at Moscow's veto. The two main Palestinian factions, Fatah and Hamas, have agreed that the Fatah leader, President Mahmoud Abbas, will head an interim government to organise elections. The arrangement comes after months of negotiations between President Abbas and the Hamas leader, Khaled Mashal. John Donison reports.
There have been plenty of false dawns for Palestinian political reconciliation, and people here will want to see if unity works in practice, not just on paper. There remain serious differences in policy, not least how to deal with Israel, which regards Hamas as a terrorist organisation. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, rejected the deal and said President Abbas had to choose between peace with Israel or a pact with Hamas.
A British court has granted bail to a radical Muslim cleric alleged to have been a leading Al-Qaeda figure in Europe. The move comes despite concern by both judges and the British government that the cleric, Abu Qatada, poses a threat to national security. He could be released next week after spending most of the past 10 years in jail without charge. Last month, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that Abu Qatada should not be deported to Jordan because of the risk that evidence obtained through torture would be used against him. The government said in a statement it was arguing for the strictest possible bail conditions for Abu Qatada. World News from the BBC. President Obama has signed an executive order tightening sanctions on Iranian assets under U.S. control. The Treasury Department said the new sanctions would affect the assets held in the U.S. of all Iranian ministries and state-owned companies and institutions, including the central bank that deals with Iran's vital oil revenues. The U.S. has spearheaded efforts to try to force Iran to stop its nuclear program. The transitional government in Somalia has started a major operation to remove tens of thousands of people who've been squatting in government buildings in the capital Mogadishu. Correspondents say it's a sign that the government is starting to restore order after years of conflict with Islamist militants. Richard Hamilton has more.
Local aid agencies estimate that more than 50,000 people have been using schools, universities and ministry buildings as makeshift shelters. The Ministry of Family and Women's Affairs has been used, appropriately enough, by 400 families. A school has also provided a temporary camp for around 17,000 internally displaced people. Many of them fled the famine in the south of the country. The aim is to house them in new camps. Much of the money for the operation is coming from Turkey, which has expressed its commitment to the reconstruction of Somalia.
Heavy rains and melting snow have caused a surge of flooding in southern Bulgaria that's left at least 8 people dead. The government has declared a state of emergency and warned that massive floods are surging down 2 rivers towards Turkey and Greece. Gun salutes have marked the 60th anniversary today of Queen Elizabeth's accession to the throne. They herald the start of a year of celebrations here in Britain and the 15 other countries where the Queen reigns. The British government has marked the Diamond Jubilee by pledging $80 million to a new trust to support poorer Commonwealth nations. BBC News.
Welcome back, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, thousands of Nigerians took to the streets to protest corruption and the government's decision to end oil subsidies, which doubled the price of many commodities. Labor unions in Nigeria ended a 6-day national strike on January 17th after President Goodluck Jonathan partially restored the subsidies that keep gasoline prices low. Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa, is one of the world's largest oil producers. It pumps 2 million barrels of oil every day, bringing in about $45 billion a year in revenue. But the abundance of oil has not translated into prosperity for the majority of its citizens. 70% of the population lives on less than a dollar a day, while many Nigerian lawmakers bring in $1 million a year, and states have budgets larger than many neighboring countries. Along with economic factors, Nigeria is grappling with rampant political corruption and religious and ethnic tensions. Young Nigerians have turned to social media to mobilize. According to Trendistic, the hashtag Occupy Nigeria became a global trend early in January, but the government was forced to rethink its policy after the oil workers threatened to go on strike and halt oil production. Now, in order to stop popular protests, President Goodluck Jonathan ordered soldiers to take over security in Nigeria's major cities, which raises concerns about freedom of speech. The group Save Nigeria, which has organized many mass demonstrations, released a statement saying, quote, "This is a clear case of intolerance and shutting of the democratic space against the people of Nigeria, which must be condemned by all democracy-loving people around the world." So on today's Your Call, we are talking about what is in store for the future of Nigeria. How vibrant is the civil society and various social movements? What is being done with all of the oil revenue? And how are global actors such as the IMF affecting the economic policies of Nigeria? Today, we're joined by Michael Watts, professor of geography and development studies at UC Berkeley. He first went to Nigeria in 1972. He is author of the photojournalism book, Curse of the Black Gold, 50 Years of Oil in the Niger Delta. His most recent research is called Economies of Violence, Petroleum, Politics, and Community Conflict in the Niger Delta. And Professor Watts joins us in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Rose.
We are also joined by Saware. He is a human rights activist and founder and publisher of SaharaReporters.com. It's a website of citizen journalists supplying videos and articles exposing corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. Hi, Saware. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for bringing me.
Nice to have you. So why don't we first start off by talking about what we need to know about Nigeria. It does get coverage, but based on the articles I read, there's very little context here. So, Saware, in addition to some of the facts that I mentioned in the intro, what else do you think we need to know about Nigeria?
Well, it's important to begin to look at Nigeria for a very diverse, ethnically diverse country. There are about 250 different ethnic groups and nationalities mixed together in present-day Nigeria. And it's, you know, roughly half of the country is Christian, roughly half is Muslims, and in between animists and people who don't write our religions. So, and Nigeria got independent in 1960 from the British, and oil exploration started in Nigeria in 1956. So, since that period, Nigeria has sold some $500 billion worth of oil to different parts of the world. And most of this money has been frittered away, mismanaged, or outrightly stolen by a corrupt elite that work hand-in-hand with corrupt multinational corporations that have polluted and destroyed the Nigerian environment in the course of oil exploration.
And Sowore, we're going to call you right back to try to get another line. Thank you for that explanation. And while we do that, Michael Watts, what would you add to that? What do you think we need to know about Nigeria?
Well, probably most Americans aren't aware of how important the country is in their lives. Mm. Both you and Sowore mentioned the fact it's a major oil producer. Now about 2.3 million barrels a day. That accounts for about 10, sometimes as close to 15% of all U.S. oil imports. So the chances are, if you're driving a car, you have some intimate connection with that country. Mm. Secondly, it's a hugely important country, politically, geostrategically. It has a population of about 160 million. One in every five Africans is a Nigerian, for example. The economy is huge, $250 billion. And therefore, in a sense, the future of, I would say, not just the region, West African region in Africa, but the continent is very much wrapped up with the political stability and the prospects for real development in that country.
And now I would like to welcome Professor Kole Adutola. He teaches in the Department of Languages, Literature, and Culture at the University of Florida, and he is author of Diaspora and Imagined Nationality, USA-Africa Dialogue, and Cyberframing Nigerian Nationhood. Hi, Professor Adutola. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. So what else would you like to add to that? What do you think Americans need to know about Nigeria?
Well, first and foremost, let us separate the media Nigeria and the real Nigeria. The Nigeria the Americans know is the Nigerian of the scam artists. It's the Nigeria that is represented by conflicts in the media. So once we are sure that the Nigeria we're talking about is the country Nigeria and the people that have produced the first Nobel laureate for literature and have produced Chinua Achebe, who's been read in all the parts, that contextualization is very, very necessary in the minds of Westerners and Americans that, yes, Nigeria is not only about oil. Nigeria is not only about conflict. Nigeria is so many things that every other post-colonial nation is grappling with. We should contextualize and frame it in a way that everybody listening would know that Nigeria is like an elephant, just like any other country where blind people are trying to describe. It means so many things to so many people. That's very, you know, saying it mildly. Yes, we have all the political upheavals. We have corruption to the highest heavens. But you also have ordinary people who are struggling to make a living against, you know, the post-colonial crisis that they have to grapple with. So I would leave it at that and then maybe jump in when you need me again.
Okay. Well, why don't we put some context into this? Because mm-hmm. we're getting pieces of information about religious violence. That's in almost every article I've read. Ethnic tensions. Mm-hmm. What would you say is really happening right now on the ground in Nigeria? We saw the Occupy Nigeria movement really explode last month. And it's gaining ground, especially among young Nigerians. So put all of this in context for us.
Like every other developing country that has the state, the skeleton of a state put in place before the colonial masters departed, Nigeria was, like Walesho Inka would say, clobbered together. People of different ethnic nationalities, of different religious bias. And Nigeria has been a country that has always, or the people have always risen up to protest. They've always risen up to stand up against either the colonial masters or risen up to face the new colonialists that took over from the departing whites, or even rise up against the military. So the question of protest, of rising up, of speaking up, it's almost become a culture and a tradition. Now, having said that, you also will remember that those who are marginalized from power would also be marginalized from the benefits of power. We have different ethnic groups, but literature always harps on the major ethnic groups, the Hausa, the Igbo, and the Yorubas. But this is really not the picture. We have the minority groups that if they came together, they would form a majority and probably be larger than these so-called majorities. So the ethnic tensions that had been before, now we have two kinds of struggles. One has been colored religious, and I don't really think that the Boko Haram thing happening in the north has anything to do with real religion. Mm. It is just a cover. And also presently at the Niger Delta is a struggle for self-determination and resource control. They want to take control of resources that are coming from their land. But the present outburst is really about one of the main activists of the struggle that that has been incarcerated in South Africa. And I think that is the point they want to make now. Because if you read the press release, they're saying they're going to get at the South Africans and they're going to run them out of town. And after that, they're going to now face the oil companies. So these are some of the things we need to put on the table as we discuss ethnic and religious conflicts in Nigeria.
Right, and you're talking about MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. MEND. And this is the group that took responsibility for attacking a pipeline owned by an Italian oil company on Saturday.
Yes.
So this is what gets the most attention. For example, the attacks on the pipelines and Boko Haram. Can you elaborate on that? What are your thoughts on the media coverage of these incidents?
From a media scholar perspective, I know that conflicts sell because they're easier to report. They're more dramatic. And usually those who report it are the people who are called the parachute journalists, except people like Showore, who actually has his tentacles and his eyes and ears spread all over the country. And I mean that spread all over the country. I would not be too surprised if in the presidency, three people have a meeting, and in the next 5 minutes after the meeting, you see the results on Showere's website. That's how connected he is to happenings on the ground. Having said that, the whole media representation of a Boko Haram, it's the fuzziness about it, and even to those of us who are out, there is a demand today that they want a Sharia state. Another one is the way in which Christians are dealing with Muslims and how they're killing things. But what we are hearing, the subtext of what we are hearing, is that this has to do with trying to make the country ungovernable for the president who is here now. Now, this is introducing an ethnic dimension into the struggle. Now, how far that is true, I cannot tell, but I will be the first one to confirm that I have heard it. But just most recently today, Professor Wole Soyinka granted an interview to one of the newspapers in Nigeria saying that he as well has been penciled down for assassination by the Boko Haram. Now, when you put that together, Wole Soyinka represents Western education. Boko Haram is supposed to be something that is against Western education, meaning that Western education is a sin, and that it allows all these possibilities of not living according to the dictates of the prophet. So they want to establish, according to them, a situation in which that would happen. But everybody has been saying we have to go back to the time when Sheikh Gumi was the one who was leading all of this and trying to radicalize the Muslims in the north and turned the whole thing, added a little bit of political dimension to it. And that's what we have now. It's grown to a monster. Whether the governors of the north started it or not, or whether those who lost the election started it, Nobody is for sure, but we're getting bits and pieces here and there.
And let's bring Sowore into this, because what context would you give us on this, Sowore? As the protests against the removal of fuel subsidies were taking place, there were a string of bombings in the north by the group Boko Haram, and Human Rights Watch said that the attacks on churches and suicide bombings in the first 3 weeks of this year killed more than 253 people.
That's correct. Let me start with the protests, which is something that's been underreported. It's been underreported in the sense that even the Western media did not start mentioning the protests until almost a week after about a million people were converging in places like Lagos, Kano, and Kaduna to protest against the corruption in government, waste and mismanagement in public service. And so what the protest represented was that Nigerians generally were tired with the misgovernance that's been going on in the country since 1960, and it has just not stopped, and democracy has not made any meaningful impact on their lives. And they were beginning to get angry, especially young people. There are about 40% of Nigerians are young, below the age of 30, let's say. And you can imagine what I mean, a very restless populace. But what you can't take away from this very dynamic country is that there's a bounty, a lot of talented young people who have been kept down by mismanagement of the leadership in the country. But going to Boko Haram, we must all connect this together. That is, each time you have a movement or a militant group come out of Nigeria, one thing is certain. It is a group that is usually started by politicians to harass their opponents, to suppress free speech, to prevent putting in elections. This is how most of these violent groups started. It was the same thing in the Niger Delta region. Most of the groups that became very violent and difficult to manage were started by politicians. They were used as ordinary thugs to harass opponents of major politicians in the area. And that is how Boko Haram started in Maiduguri. It was started by the former governor of Maiduguri, who was the governorship candidate of the ANP, that's the All Nigerian People's Party, one Bono Sharif. He started them, he paid them, he armed them, the same way they, Peter Odili armed Asare Dokubo and some of the militants in Port Harcourt in 2001 and 2003 during election seasons. So when they are done with them, they don't take back, they don't have a way to disarm them. So these groups take on different causes, one that allows them to become continuously relevant, and secondly, causes that are very popular within the society until you put them down, either by bribing them or disarming them. And usually, since the process that brought about, these people are corrupt in the first place, when they claim that there's going to be peaceful resolution of the problem, it's also half-heartedly done, and it's corruptly done. So the groups, instead of disarming, usually rearm themselves just in the cooler until another opportunity comes out, and they do what they know how to do. That's unleashing violence on innocent people, and sometimes turn on their sponsors and the police.
And the people suffer as a result. Michael Watts, what would you add to that, and also in terms of the power sharing that's going on here?
Well, you asked, you know, what's the context for these fuel price subsidy protests? I would start from the following. We shouldn't forget that Nigeria has been a major oil producer since 1958. Mm-hmm. Certainly by the end of the Civil War in 1970, 10 years after independence, oil dominated the economy. That's as true today as it is then. It's an oil-producing state. What does that mean in practice, that 2.3 million barrels per day that you referred to? It means that something like 50, 60, 70, depending on the price of oil, billion dollars flows into the government exchequers every year. That oil money represents 98% of all exports, 85% of government revenue, and close to half of the domestic product. In other words, this is a one-horse economy. It's oil sitting on, as it were, a golden egg. So the politics of this oil-dependent state are, what does the federal government do with this money by fair means or foul? It's what academics call a rentier state. And in Nigeria, because it's a federal system with 36 states, is a very complicated system by which, it's called the revenue allocation process, by which that money is distributed to the federal states and to local governments. What I would start from is by saying, if you look back at the last 30, 40 years, what you would see is that a huge amount of that oil revenue, first of all, has disappeared. It's been stolen. The World Bank says perhaps upward of $400 billion has disappeared. These are staggering numbers. Okay, and of course, that speaks to a certain culture of corruption among the political class and so on. But in practice, what has all of that oil development, quote unquote, and ended up at? Well, what we know is life expectancy in Nigeria currently is 47.
Mm.
We know, in fact, that there's been, since 1980 and 2005, a huge growth in the number of people who are falling below the poverty line. So in other words, I would say, to put it as dramatically as I can, I think we have a massive failure of oil-based development, of secular national development. And whether you are a poor young man, a Muslim in the north, whether you are an impoverished woman, Protestant evangelical in the south, or a militant in the oil-producing Niger Delta, you are part of a huge class that has been excluded from the benefits of oil.
There was an incredible quote in a 2007 National Geographic article that could have been written yesterday by Isaac Asume Osoka. He's director of Social Action Nigeria. He says, quote, "With all the oil money coming in, the state does not need taxes from people. Rather than being a resource for the state, the people are impediments. There's no incentive for the government to build schools or hospitals. I can say this," he said firmly, "Nigeria was a much better place without oil."
Yeah,
do the people still feel this way? I mean, did you hear this when you were there?
I mean, Prof. Odutola and Shwari just spoke to this very powerfully, that again, however you read Boko Haram, however you read MEND, what we can say is there's a whole generation of young men and women who have been excluded politically and economically. And in my view, that well of resentment and increasingly anger about that political economic exclusion runs very, very deep. And if you ignore that type of exclusion and impoverishment for long, you're going to get blowback. And it can take a variety of more or less nasty forms. And some of that may be, as Shwari was saying, might be triggered or indeed promoted by government corruption, by the politicians. But if you neglect it for that long, you're going to get a huge eruption. And I think that's where we are in Nigeria, where as I see it, we have essentially two insurgencies confronting the country.
So $45 billion a year in revenue from oil, and the majority of Nigerians are living off of less than a dollar a day.
Correct.
You've got at least one oil spill daily in Nigeria?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Prof, please.
Yes. I mean, it will be conservative to say there's one oil spill per day. I think putting this in the right context when they throw the statistics around. Look, you know, when you have an oil spill in Nigeria, in one neighborhood, there's also a gas flare in another, in several places. There is also some kind of accident or pipeline explosion in one place. All of this combined together is actually more than one spill per day. You know, you have an average of five, if you want to be honest, on a daily basis. And that's why the Niger Delta region has become a sludge region where waters are polluted, the air is polluted, all the seas. I mean, we had one of the biggest oil spills in 10 years, even according to Western media sources, carried out by Shell recently. But nobody has asked how it's been cleaned up, or if it's been cleaned up at all. So we've moved on to other issues, which is what we do with Nigeria. And I wanted to comment quickly when you were reading and quoting from that National Geographic article that Nigeria could have done better without oil. I don't think that's the right way to put it. I think Nigeria could have done better without the kind of leadership it had since 1960. That's what Nigeria ought to have gotten rid of. not its resources.
And Professor, hold that thought. We have to take a quick break. Today we are talking about what is happening in Nigeria, where most of the people live on less than a dollar a day, even though there's $45 billion a year in oil revenue. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. We wanted to thank all of the KALW listeners who participated in our recently completed No Interruption membership campaign, including Rachel Sultan of Oakland and David Jones of Alameda. Thank you very much for helping keep Local Public Radio strong.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can sign up for our newsletter there to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we will have a conversation about private equity now that Bain Capital is receiving so much attention because Mitt Romney spent about 20 years there. We'll have a conversation with Josh Kosman, author of Buyout of America, How Private Equity is Destroying Jobs and Killing the American Economy. We're also putting shows together about the militarization of police forces in the U.S. and banned books in Arizona, including Reimagining Columbus, which is an anthology of essays by a number of indigenous and Native American writers. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're talking about what's happening in Nigeria. Occupy Nigeria really exploded last month. A number of young people are turning to social media to mobilize. People are tired of the corruption. They're tired of the poverty and the lack of infrastructure. Nigeria brings in about $45 billion a year in oil revenue, but most people live on less than a dollar a day. If you drive, chances are you're pumping Nigerian oil into your car. The U.S. is the largest purchaser of Nigerian oil, buying almost one-fifth of its output. So if you have any questions about what actually is happening in Nigeria, it gets a lot of attention when there's an oil explosion or when there's religious violence. But today we're trying to put all of that into context. So if you have any questions about what's happening on the ground, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you're a Nigerian, we'd love to hear from you. If you've been there, what do you want us to know about what happens in that country? We are closely aligned, but don't really hear about it much other than the violence that's going on. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Michael Watts, professor of geography and development at UC Berkeley. He first went to Nigeria in 1972. He's author of Curse of the Black Gold, 50 Years of Oil in the Niger Delta. And be sure to go to yourcallradio.org and you can see these incredible photos that were taken by Ed Kashi in the Niger Delta. We're also joined by Saware, human rights activist and founder of Sahara Reporters. That's a website of citizen journalists to expose corruption in Nigeria. And Professor Akole Adutola. He teaches in the Department of Languages, Literature, and Culture at the University of Florida. And Professor, you wanted to comment on a quote I read from Isaac Asume Asuka. He's director of Social Action Nigeria. He believes that Nigeria was a better place without oil. And you disagree with that. You said
like Sowore did say that the problem really is about leadership. I would also want to add that some of what we are seeing, now, the demonstrations and the protests is also the lack of a political space in which the people, ordinary people, can participate. To run for any position or any post in Nigeria, you have to know somebody. The whole thing has been so muddied that we haven't developed, as it were, that culture, the democratic culture, right from
either the schools or even the churches. There's hardly anywhere where an average Nigerian has been able to imbibe. You know, so that close and the restriction to the political space, the ability to contribute meaningfully and make a change. A lot of people have been close to it. And these are some of the reactions. I do agree that we can go the economic deterministic route to say, well, it's also because people are poor. Yes, people are poor, that's one. People are also unable to make a change, the kind of change they want. When we vote, we are just, ours is not, we don't have elections. We have what is called selections. Some godfather somewhere just puts down somebody, and the votes are all rigged. Even in places where the ruling power, the ruling party, can win an election without doing anything, they still go ahead to rig the election. And these are some of the things. After 50 years, now Nigeria will be 52, we still have not gotten it right. We still have not been able to create democratic institutions, strong democratic institutions that will outlive every other person there. But what we have is just people who live for their own self-interest and their families. And unfortunately, the amount of corruption we have in that place is just, it's abnormal. It's totally abnormal.
And Sowore, before we let you go, what would you add to that? And what are you hearing from the citizen journalists on the ground? Where do they see this going?
Well, you know, nobody can predict where this is. To say he can, that would be a lie. Nigeria has a very peculiar history and nature. The reason why I say so is that I describe Nigeria as a country that is... you know, it's like a butterfly sometimes. That is, it can never rise to a bird, but it doesn't fall to the ground, right? It will be shocking to find out that in another maybe 2 months, Nigeria will come together again. They would have gone past the issue of Boko Haram. But what that means is that they would have moved on to a bigger problem. Nobody is interested in solving the problem in Nigeria because the corrupt elites who run the place prefer that things go this way because this is how their mass work. This also acts for them as a means of diverting attention from socio-political issues. When you talk about Boko Haram, you know, Niger Delta insurgency, this is the kind of time that they amass unbelievable and you know, speakable and despicable wealth to their private real estate. The country itself is a real estate that belongs to a few, less than 1% in our own case. And until people address that, until we address that, Nigeria will continue to face all kinds of problems. But it's also not impossible that Nigeria as a nation, or the way it is governed, or the elites will run out of luck pretty soon. I just don't know when it will happen, but I don't think this will last forever. But I don't think that Nigeria will come to an end in 2 weeks. As it sounds, you know, it's a nation that will also go through this kind of motions without movement.
Well, Sowore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sowore is a human rights activist and founder of SaharaReporters.com, a website of citizen journalists who expose official corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. And why don't we talk a little bit, Michael, about the oil companies in Nigeria, up to 5 oil spills every day. Is there any accountability here? And we're talking about Royal Dutch Shell, Exxon, Chevron, Total SA, and Italy's Eni.
Yeah.
And they run joint ventures with the state oil company Nigerian National Petroleum that pump more than 90% of the country's crude.
Mm-hmm. Let me just start, if I can, with the ecological footprint.
Please,
and
yes.
Sowore talked a little bit about this. According to the statistics, which are almost certainly an underestimation, that are provided by the National Nigerian Petroleum Company, since 1970 there have been over 8,000 oil spills. Secondly, many of your listeners will, of course, be familiar with the terrible, terrifying events in the Gulf of Mexico when Deepwater Horizon exploded. Every year, collectively, the number of spills in the Niger Delta, the oil-producing region, amount to an equivalent of a Gulf of Mexico deep water spill every year. And that's been the case roughly since 1960. Third little piece of evidence is last year there was a hugely important report produced by the United Nations Environment Programme. And it was important because I've just been talking about oil spills and so on, and yet we don't really have a well-documented scientific record of the number of these spills and their ecological impact. And incidentally, many of the oil companies will use that lack of evidence, which they're not particularly interested in collecting, incidentally, in order to deny the significance of these spills. The United Nations Environment Programme was the first serious inventory of oil spills in one very small area, the Ogoni area. And some of, again, your listeners will know that word because it refers to a small ethnic group in the Niger Delta that was associated with a very charismatic human rights and environmental leader, Ken Sarawiwa, who brought this very same issue to the world stage in 1990. And that movement that he led, MOSOP, the movement of the Ogoni people, was brought to a terrifying conclusion in 1995 when he was hung by the Nigerian military. Well, in that Ogoni area, what the United Nations Environment Program discovered was, in fact, that in that 400 square mile area, 20 by 20 miles, it would take the oil companies, and Shell has been the primary operator there, 25 years and $1 billion to rehabilitate the consequences of those oil spills. So that gives you right there just a sense of the magnitude of the problem. The World Wildlife Foundation a few years ago said that the Niger Delta, which is a magnificent area of tropical rainforest, a huge arcuate delta, was one of the most environmentally polluted spots on the face of the earth. So that's the ecological cost of this industry in this part of the world. Secondly, very briefly, you mentioned about the oil companies and so on. Yes, there are five majors, all of whom operate jointly, in joint ventures with the National Nigerian Petroleum Company. And that's incidentally why Mr. Sarawiwa always referred to the oil industry in terms of what he called the slick alliance. So you may think the oil companies are bad news, but they operate jointly with an equally corrupt and bad government. It's very much a slick alliance, and you can't separate them. That story, it seems to me, is that for a long period of time after 1960, when Nigeria became an oil producer, the oil companies got away with whatever they could get away with. It was only when, essentially, popular mobilization of various sorts began to raise the impact of the oil industry, whether in terms of income, infrastructure, environment, that gradually you had the emergence of what you and I would now call corporate social responsibility. And that began really in the 1980s. And companies began to explicitly outreach to communities in the oil-producing area to try to both respond to complaints and criticisms of oil spills and so on, but also through things called community development. I think what we could say is that much of that came too little, far too late. And by that time, in fact, in any case, there was so much local resentment within the oil-producing communities that young men and women were turning to other outlets for their grievances. And that's, in my view, where the insurgency in the Delta began to emerge.
That is Michael Watts, professor of geography and development at UC Berkeley. He first went to Nigeria in 72. He's author of Curse of the Black Gold, 50 Years of Oil in the Niger Delta. I hope you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org, to see some of these photos taken by Ed Koshy. Just incredible photos. What's amazing about this, Michael, is the contrast between what you just described as the green, lush landscape and then just this black oil that is covering everything, including people's bodies.
Yeah, I mean, the Ed's images are quite extraordinary. And with the one on the cover, which we're just looking at, shows, in fact, two oil workers who are cleaning up a very large spill in a community called Nembe, absolutely covered in oil. Many of these spills, of course, have devastating consequences for the livelihoods of people in this area. Most people in the Delta are fishermen and farmers. Mm. And once a spill of this sort happens, of course, even with cleanup, rehabilitation will take a very long time. And often, in fact, it simply will never be fully rehabilitated.
And there aren't that many fishermen left, I understand.
Livelihoods. I mean, this is partly why you have these very high rates of unemployment, is that the livelihood systems, which turn on agriculture and fishing, have been so devastated by oil spills, also incidentally by dredging. This is an untold story. This is a large deltaic area, perhaps not unlike the Mississippi in some respects. And the oil industry has had a massive impact in dredging in order that barges and other riverine traffic can bring equipment up into these delta areas. And that's had a huge impact on these very delicate tropical ecosystems.
We're speaking today about what is going on the ground in Nigeria. A huge Occupy movement sprung up last month. Obviously, this has been going on for many decades, mass movements in Nigeria. The young people are now using social media to bring people onto the streets. And if you have any questions about what's happening on the ground in Nigeria, if you're a Nigerian American, if you've been to Nigeria, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Professor Kole Adutola. He teaches in the Department of Language, Literature, and Culture at the University of Florida. And Professor, what do you think we need to know about the group MEND and the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta? They recently released a press release detailing new plans to attack oil infrastructures in the Niger Delta. As you said before, they plan to attack South African businesses. They took responsibility for attacking a pipeline owned by Italy's Eni unit on Saturday. What are they trying to accomplish by blowing up oil pipelines?
Okay. Before I go there, just a little one. Sure. MOSOP actually is the movement for the survival of Ogoni people. And I think the emphasis should be on survival. Mm. And then you would see how from MOSOP we eventually got onto MED. Before I address that, I would also would like Professor Wa to address the question of when we started to have blowouts. And these blowouts and these oil spills that we're having, are they offshore? Are they through the pipelines? And are we not going to be sincere enough to say that there are cases of sabotage, that this is another way of a people calling attention to their own communities? You know, the history, he said something about CSR. CSR is a later day intervention by Shell. What they were doing before was called philanthropy. They were providing hospitals and schools and staff. I'm one of those who would say that they haven't done enough. I'm one of those who would want to demonize them to say that they are the evil, they're the two devils with two horns. But as an academic, we have to dissociate, you know, disaggregate, stand out of what the facts on the ground are, and then be able to. It's not all of this that is there is a result of blowout. There are some of it, and I maybe out of 10, maybe half. But let's admit the fact that there is also a question of sabotage. And why would there be sabotage? The intra-power play within the communities is also a very important one. The question in Niger Delta is a very complex one. It's a very complex one. One of the evils of Shell is the inability of Shell itself to publicize what he does and how he does it. But whenever there is something that is wrong, others speak on their behalf. And I'll be the very last person to support Shell and its activities. But as an academic, I would want us to put everything on the table so that the listeners can at least have a fair understanding of what is happening on ground. Yes, there is oil spill. Yes, Shell is unable to. But if you look at the way in which they want to respond, that the communities where the thing has taken place refuse them entry. These are all parts and parcel of what we must understand. And I'm not trying to bring some kind of sympathy to Shell, but I'm just saying that the complexity
of the situation. When Sarowiwa, one of the things that Ken spoke about, you will remember that the managing director of Shell at the time when Ken Sarowiwa was eventually murdered by the state was a white guy who was actually born in Port Harcourt. And he uses that to say that he's also a son of the soil. But what Ken Sarowiwa kept on saying was that the state had more to blame for. We have a three-tier system in Nigeria, even in the Delta area. We have a state that collects money from the joint venture. They collect a certain percentage of it. There's a local government in this in Nigeria. And are we going to also ask the local government that are citizens, that are indigents of the place, what are you doing with your resources? I mean, if all of this, the state, the local government, and then with what Shell was doing, if they all added, we would have a different Niger Delta. So yes, the problem is corruption from the top right down to the bottom. You know, so these are some of the issues I would like to place. So MEND that you talk about and how it became what it became. Yes, it's Sowore already gave you a perspective that yes, they all came and the politicians used them. But let's also look at it without being naive at all, that these militants already had something they wanted, but they were looking for a means to register their anger in the way in which things were being mismanaged between the state and by Shell. And they found the politicians ready partners who needed them. And as soon as they used the politicians to an extent, they dispensed of them, and the politicians also dispensed of them, and they went on to their greatest struggle. The Orca, who was one of the primary motivators of MEND, the guy who could actually get the ammunition and the guns, who knew? I mean, he is a licensed weapons seller. He knows where to get them. He was very instrumental in what was happening on the ground. Now he is in jail in South Africa. And it seems as if nobody is...
Sorry to cut you off, but we have a number of listener questions via email. I also wanted to go to a caller, and then we'll get Professor Watts to respond. Let's hear from Philip in Albany. Hi, Philip.
Hello. Hello?
Hi, you're on. Go ahead. We're almost out of time. Go ahead.
I'd like to get an idea of the tribal situation in Nigeria. Which tribes are the main tribes, and which tribes are dominant in national government? Which tribes tend to be Christian, which tend to be Muslim?
All right, and we touched on that earlier in the show. Thank you for the question. I just want to read a couple other questions, and then you both can respond. Where can people in the Bay Area go to get involved and stay informed? What can we do here in the U.S. to improve the situation? Can you talk about the U.S. perspective on Boko Haram and what the U.S. is doing related to this perceived threat? What does U.S. involvement in this matter mean for Nigerians? And also questions about how the oil is affecting health in Nigeria. That's a lot of questions, I know. Well, why don't you talk about the U.S. involvement? Because we're almost out of time and we haven't touched on that yet.
Well, can I just say, for those people who are interested in more information, there is actually a Bay Area group called Justice in Nigeria. The acronym is JINN. They have a wonderful website. They have daily updates and so on. The group Platform, based in D.C. and London, is also a terrific source of information around oil issues in Nigeria. And, of course, Sahara Reporters. Shaware's website is a fantastic source of information.
And we'll put that on our website.
Let me just say a couple of things before, very briefly. Prof raised the important issue about oil spills, and let me say that, of course, oil spills can happen for a variety of reasons. I didn't say anything about how they happened. They can happen because of a corrosion in the materials themselves, the pipelines. They can happen because they're sabotaged and attacked by militants. They can happen because oil thieves illegally tap the oil pipelines and they spill and or explode. So for a whole variety of reasons, and of course, if you know anything about the oil industry, is that the oil companies and the Nigerian government and civil rights groups are constantly arguing about whether an event was the result of sabotage, neglect, oil theft, and so on and so forth. And of course, the larger issue here, which I think Prof was getting toward, is that, of course, it would be irresponsible to simply see this devastating picture in the oil delta or the oil story in Nigeria as being entirely the product of corporate irresponsibility or corporate corruption, of which there is a great deal. That's why Ken Sarawiwa spoke powerfully about the Slick Alliance. So I think all of those things are important. Just on very briefly on your question about the U.S., I mean, obviously, the U.S. has historically played an important role in Nigeria. I think right now the primary axis is not so much in the Niger Delta, where that insurgency and that military activity associated with MEND, which appeared in late 2005, effectively closed down the oil fields by 2009. They successfully, whatever you think about their tactics and what they represented politically, they effectively closed down the oil fields. There was then an amnesty and a truce, and the temperature has been reduced. Now the issue is the U.S. sees it is, of course, in the north and Boko Haram. And there have been reports circulating in the U.S. diplomatic and military community saying that, Boko Haram, they actually have connections with AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. They're being trained there. Ditto in Somalia with Shabab. And so suddenly the military apparatus in the U.S. sees, in fact, Boko Haram in terms of a part of a global war on terror, of a Muslim insurgency. And I think the huge danger here is of the Nigerian government turning to the U.S. for various types of military or security advice, and in trying to resolve this issue in the north militarily through some type of military counterinsurgency practice. Because I think, whatever you think about Boko Haram, there are large numbers of Muslims in the north who in fact share certain views which are quite similar to those of Boko Haram, namely that there has been political and economic exclusion. They don't necessarily want to reimpose Sharia law. But Boko Haram, among other things, isn't just anti-Western education. It has a ferocious critique of the Nigerian state and of political corruption and of economic collapse and neglect. And that resonates very, very deeply. And so it would be a disaster, in my view, to have the U.S. involved in some way endorsing a Nigerian military response to Boko Haram.
Professor Ajitola, we only have 30 seconds left. Final thoughts from you. Where does this go from here?
Well, what I would expect that a lot of people do is to actually give a greater study to the various areas in which the Nigerian problem is, understanding. And I think a little bit more attention on some of the positive things that are happening in the country, in the media, in the West, would also help a people reimagine themselves as able to correct their own problems. Yes, the Boko Haram thing, it's what Prof has said, yes, there's part of it there, but there's also the fact that these folks might totally be misguided. And that's very possible. And they, from the news that is just coming out of Sahara Reporter, the former guy that's been held is talking about intra-power struggle within the Boko Haram itself. And I think that has never been, it's been public knowledge.
Well, we will definitely continue watching this and continuing this conversation. Professor Kole Adutola and Professor Michael Watts, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What is private equity and how is it shaping our economy? On the next Your Call, we'll be joined by Josh Kosman, author of Buyout of America, How Private Equity is Destroying Jobs and Killing the American Economy. Private equity firms own companies employing about one out of every 10 Americans. So what are the economic effects of private equity deals? And what is the relationship between private equity firms and Washington power players? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.